the educational panel on the political nature of NATO and G8, very important topics. We have extremely experienced and knowledgeable speakers to talk about that today. Obviously, it's not going to be the last time we're going to need to be talking about this, but it gives us an introduction to the nature of NATO and G8. The first speaker is going to be Ashley Smith. He's on the UNAC Administrative Committee and very active in Vermont. Ashley, thank you.
All right. So, in the interest of time, you can applaud afterward if you like it, I have to say. Obviously, we face a twin-headed monster that's coming to Chicago in May this coming year, in May 2012, the NATO and G8. And it reminds me of a William Butler Yeats program and poem in which he talked about a strange, rough-backed beast slouching towards Jerusalem, in his case. But they're going to be slouching towards Chicago. And these two organizations are essentially the main architects of war and austerity in the world system today. And the Emmanuel administration, as we heard from the experience in Canada, could spend upwards of $1 billion to host this conference. When you think about what that money could go to, in terms of education, healthcare, jobs, the reconstruction of our infrastructure, green jobs, addressing the environmental crisis in our society, you get a sense of the social cost of hosting this conference. NATO, as we know, is comprised of 28 different member countries, most of them in Europe and now in Eastern Europe, but also Canada. And it was originally the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that was concentrated on Europe. Now it's on three different continents. It's in Central Asia, in Afghanistan, it's in Libya, and it's doing training in Iraq. So this is a morphing organization that's got a much bigger profile than it used to have. The G8 is a club of all the main capitalist powers, or used to be all the capitalist powers: France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Britain, the United States, Canada, and Russia. Historically, this has been used to impose neoliberal structural adjustment programs on third world countries, as well as implement policies of a similar sort domestically. And right now, they're trying to manage an enormous crisis in the world system that's been going on since 2008. So these two organizations are going to be meeting. They have met before at the same time, and it was the last time of a great imperial and economic crisis. They met together in London in 1977. In the aftermath of the defeat of the United States in Vietnam, which was a victory for the world's population, and in the wake of the economic crisis that began in the 1970s, the period of stagflation. And in that meeting, they began the drive for rehabilitating imperial intervention and developing neoliberal economic policies that they would then impose on the planet for the next 30 years to raise the profits of a crisis-ridden system. So this coming May, they'll meet for the second time together amidst exactly the same kind of crisis, a different period in history. It's not exactly the same, but a profound imperial crisis that the Obama administration inherited from the Bush administration. That is, two disastrous wars, a disastrous occupation of Iraq, for the Iraqi people, a million people killed, but also a disastrous occupation for the ability of the U.S. to dominate the planet militarily. It was a tremendous weakening moment for the United States. Also a disastrous occupation of Afghanistan, tens of thousands of Afghans and now Pakistanis being killed by the drones that the U.S. has unleashed in the course of its occupation. But that's similarly a profoundly problematic occupation for U.S. imperialism. They also face this disastrous economic crisis that they are seeing mutate underneath themselves. Obviously, it began in 2008, and they proceeded to, you know, amidst the giant financial crisis, bail out the banks, bail out the corporations, spend trillions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars on bailing out these giant corporations and banks, and they basically put all that debt on the coffers of the government. So now we have a sovereign debt crisis. All the major economic powers are saddled with a big budgetary crisis, and in reaction to that, they're imposing massive austerity on all the world's working classes, all throughout Europe, all throughout the United States, and in much of the developing world. And you can just see what it's done to countries like Greece, where they're getting rid of people's pensions, cutting their standard of living by a third, raising the unemployment rate as a result of these economic austerity measures. And the crisis is so severe that it's an open question whether the European Union and the euro is going to hold together, given the impact of the crisis in Europe. So the combination of these two crises, I think, have really weakened the United States, the master of war and empire in the world system, and it's caused a giant legitimacy crisis for most of the world's governments, in the United States included. There was just a Reuters poll that asked people whether they thought that the U.S. government had the consent of the governed. They found that only 17% of the American population thought that the U.S. government had the consent of the governed, and the Reuters pollster said that this is a sign of pre-revolutionary consciousness, which is a stunning thing for a Reuters pollster to say. And that kind of delegitimation of the governments that are going to be represented in the NATO and G8 summit, that's going on a global scale. That's without exception. But it's not only a change in people's attitudes towards the government and the priorities of the government, it's also provoking mass resistance from one corner of the world to the other. In Europe, the massive campaign of austerity that these G8 countries have launched have created a wave of general strikes from Greece to Spain to France, and a riot in Britain in reaction to a police murder, all the budget cuts, the history of attacks on people's standard of living, and the vicious racism. And it's emerging now in Chile, where we had a demonstration in Chile of 1 million people, which is an incredible sign of the radicalization that's developing. So those are just a couple of examples from Europe and Latin America. The U.S. is not immune from similar kinds of dynamics. The massive austerity measures that are being conducted at the federal level, the state level, and the local level are provoking a shift in consciousness and provoking struggle, most dramatically in Wisconsin, where the lunatic governor of Wisconsin stripped union rights away. In a reaction, tens of thousands of union members occupied the Capitol building in Wisconsin. On the private sector, it's provoked the Verizon strike, where you have an incredibly profitable American corporation that's rolling in dough, is trying to cut people's wages, benefits, take away their pensions, take away their bargaining rights, et cetera. And it produced a strike. So you're seeing the beginnings of resistance to the global austerity in the United States as well. But by far the biggest threat to the United States, NATO, and the G8 is the Arab Spring, where the combination of austerity measures, decades of dictatorship, and horrible policies in the wake of the economic crisis has provoked a wave of revolt throughout the Middle East and North Africa, beginning in Tunisia, spreading to Egypt, spreading to almost every country, Syria, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Jordan, Libya, et cetera, on and on and on. You have a wave of resistance to the impact of the crisis and people rising up to fight for their democratic control of their own society. So in this context, NATO and G8 are coming to meet. They've got a world of trouble in front of them. So the US, NATO, and G8 are scrambling to manage these twin crises, the imperial crises. They're meeting to manage this profound crisis in the system. And essentially their agenda is going to be to collaborate on how to impose austerity in each of their countries and manage the world economic crisis, and how to get in front of the wave of resistance that's sweeping the world through interventions like Libya, through police state measures, et cetera. So they are going to be trying to find a way to continue their agenda of war and austerity. And the reality is the whole world will be watching their meeting, and the whole world will be watching what we do here in Chicago. And we have a major international obligation to unite all of our forces together, to mobilize people in their thousands, to reach out to the broadest network of organizations so that we can represent what we know is a majority opinion against the priorities of the warmongers and the architects of austerity. So we should continue the discussion about NATO and G8 and build the demonstration to our most serious and determined extent. Thank you.
Next speaker is a leader of the anti-war movement. He's with the Mobilization for Peace, Jobs, and Justice in San Francisco, and also on the Administrative Committee of UNAC. Jeff Mackler came here from San Francisco.
Well, Ashley and I had a detailed discussion about how we would organize our division of labor for this talk, and his subject was NATO and mine was G8. But I think he took G8, now I have to take NATO. So anyway, I will leave out much of what Ashley said, which I totally agree with. G8 was originally G6, formed in 1975 at the impetus of the French president Giscard d'Estaing at the end of the Vietnam War. It subsequently morphed into G6 when they added Russia and Canada, and now there are five more nations that in Pittsburgh with G8 were slated to be added. But essentially, it was conceived as a meeting of the richest or the wealthiest nations in the world. When it started, it represented 52% of the world's GDP. That's five nations. Today, with the addition of China, who will be prominent in the meeting, and other such countries, it probably represents the 13 nations that that collectively produce 75% of the world's GDP. The main nations on Earth today are in great crisis. NATO in the past was a subordinate imperial institution formed in 1949 and reflected the relationship of forces between the United States that emerged as the dominant nation and still is the dominant military nation, but the United States is no longer the dominant economic nation. The combination of forces, 350 million people that constitute the European Union, for example, have a GDP that is virtually equal to the United States. And the United States in major areas of world finance, banking, corporations, production, steel, is now in second or third place and declining. So this NATO meeting, in a certain sense, as you saw in Libya, is sort of an adjustment of the world relationship of forces. It was the French that played a central role in providing the military support in initially against the wishes of the United States in the smashing of the Libyan state. So what's the context of these meetings? This is the 38th time the G8 has met. It meets roughly yearly, and the host rotates, and now President Obama is the host of this and organizes the agenda. It meets at a time when the system is in the greatest crisis since the Great Depression, if not worse. At the end of that Great Depression, there was a war that took the lives, World War II, of 80 million people, and the United States emerged as the preeminent nation in the world economy, militarily and politically. All of its enemies and opponents were destroyed. By the 1970s, Europe had rebuilt as well as Japan and Germany, and the United States was no longer or was beginning to lose its status in the world economy. At the end of World War II, the United States was the world's greatest creditor nation. It didn't owe anybody a dime, roughly speaking. Today, it's the world's greatest debtor nation. And of course, the debts are being taken out of the hides of working people. The exact same thing is happening in every country on Earth today, including all of the European countries. And there have been massive, so there's been a change in the relationship of forces, and each of these international meetings seeks to try, like the World Trade Organization, to negotiate the difference as to which nation is going to get the largest share of the booty extracted from working people and the poor all over the earth. In the past, the United States didn't need NATO. It could just intervene with a mandate from the United Nations or just go in itself with a, quote, coalition of the willing. This time, the NATO forces want to, in the course of establishing a neo-colonial world that they previously established, they want to reestablish that. That's what these wars are all over the world, the recolonization of Africa, Latin America, and all poor nations on Earth. Today, all capitalist nations, all nations on Earth, have a great crisis. And that is the level of competition on a worldwide scale has reduced profit rates to the point where it is no longer productive for any capitalist industry to invest in new plants. That's why we have 25 million unemployed in the United States today. It's not profitable when your plant can't compete on world markets. Hence, the government essentially nationalized General Motors, destroyed the contracts of the strongest unions in the country, and reorganized industry. It's profitable, therefore, to not invest in nations where there are high wages. So the United States went from the unionized North to the South to the maquiladoras, which laid off a 500,000 people in the last couple of years because the 250 wage rate was too high for American employers, 250 a day. They went to Guatemala, where they had workers for 37 cents, and then to Haiti, where Aristide, in all his majesty, raised wages to 19 cents an hour from 10, and they had a coup to throw him out because that was too much. And then to China, where they had workers for 6 cents an hour. That is young women who are teenagers working in dormitory factories for 70 hours a week at roughly 6 cents an hour. But wages have risen in China, so they're now going to lower, even lower wages countries. They, meaning all of the nations in G8, are going to Bangladesh, Indonesia, and even in the United States to the virtual slave labor manufacturing plants that are called the prison industrial complex, where they have a majority, the average wage in the of a 2.5 million people in prison, majority black and Latino, is 50 cents an hour. Texas and Georgia don't pay anything. And the same thing with the attacks on immigrants. So our response is truly going to have to be an international response. I attended a conference in Belgium about a year ago. And I heard speakers from some 50, 70 countries describe the massive mobilizations of the working classes of their countries, including 8 general strikes, as actually mentioned in Greece, 4 million people out on strike in France, millions demonstrating in Spain, Ireland, Portugal, and everywhere else in the world. And the one common thread that went through all of the reports of the working class fight back was that in not one country did the ruling classes offer a single concession. That is, all of these mass mobilizations were defeated. They were half-hearted, one-day general strikes. They were important mobilizations, but it convinced everyone that even more powerful, united demonstrations, protests, and strikes are necessary to meet this offensive. This offensive is going to come to the United States, where they're going to make plans to do what they have to do. And that is today 40% of the United States, for example, of all of the profits generated in the United States come from financial speculation. It's not profitable to invest in factories anymore. So they go into these Ponzi schemes that blow up when the bubbles are artificial bubbles collapse. And pensions are destroyed, and every other aspect of working class life that people have counted on for a lifetime evaporates before our eyes. We are organizing a tactical, massive mobilization in Chicago, a united tactical mass mobilization. I say tactic because mass demonstrations, as I've just demonstrated in Europe, are not the only tactic available to working people. Eventually, those tactics are going to become even more militant tactics, like strikes that close down industries, like inclusion of Latinos in the unions. Millions of Latinos are non-union, are not organized because the officials in the trade union movement fear that they threaten jobs in the United States, which is essentially allowing any worker to be paid a lower rate, lowers the average wage of all workers. So it hurts the trade union movement that the Latino community and the black community and others are excluded from any fighting organization of the working class. So we are going to see actions on the scale of Europe and much greater. We're going to see actions that challenge the bosses, not just in the streets, but at the point of production in coordinated, united ways that challenge the system itself. The problem is not that Obama is not a nice guy. I'm sure he is. He has a wonderful daughter, wonderful wife, and wrote a book. And he is the servant of the people who run the country. I wrote an article recently to describe, and I'm going to close on this, to describe what happened when Benjamin Bernanke and the Secretary of the Treasury, Paulson, walked into the White House, passed by George Bush, and told him that on these two pieces of paper, we're going to have to ask for $700 billion in TARP, and otherwise the nation's economy will collapse. And George Bush said, "Why didn't anybody tell me?" He proceeded to go into the Congress, and in a matter of days of negotiation, the congressional representatives of the ruling rich granted $700 billion. And who organized the meeting? A bunch of guys sitting around a mahogany table in Washington, D.C., who run the country, who own the wealth and the resources. They are the same people, the same group that does the same thing in every country on earth. They have to rev up the war machine and NATO and other military alliances in order to extract from working people the wealth that they produce, the resources that they reproduce. Our job is to represent the majority of the people on Earth. Our job is to present humanity's agenda, not the agenda of the elite few who rule the world for profit, regardless of what party they're in. This is the beginning mobilization of that process of challenging the war makers on every front and of engaging the unions, the communities of the oppressed, the social activists, the youth in a mighty struggle that sends a message across the globe that we can win, that we are the majority, that we represent the majority, and we have the power to build a new world. Thank you.
The third and last speaker of this session is Rick Rozoff from the Stop NATO Newsletter.
Hello. You know, truthfully, and I'm offering my services in the future, I think I could spend 5 hours without any exaggeration rather than 5 minutes laying out. I could spend substantially more time, and I'm offering to do so in future events, to discuss the role of NATO in the post-Cold War era. I think it's something insufficiently appreciated, but let me begin with a quote from a column in a newspaper from Tanzania 2 days ago, a newspaper called The Citizen, in which NATO was characterized as being the mailed fist of 21st century neo-imperialism. I think that's as terse and accurate a characterization of this military bloc as I can think of. It is the armed enforcement agency for the post-Cold War era New World Order, if you will. It is one that has grown, as I think previous speakers have talked about, from 16 members in 1999 to 28 members a decade later. That's a 75% increase. Mm-hmm. That goes from Eastern Europe, from the Baltic Sea to the Adriatic Sea. Unbeknownst to most people, however, NATO is not limited simply to its 28 full members. It has a series of transitional partnership programs, which take in, at least by my count, 68 countries in the world, which is comfortably over a third of the nations in the United Nations. These are programs like Partnership for Peace, Mediterranean Dialogue, Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, Contact Country Category, the Tripartite Afghanistan, Pakistan, NATO Commission, and so forth. This goes from the Atlantic coast of Africa and Mauritania to the Chinese border in Kazakhstan. This is greater NATO. Mm-hmm. NATO is in control of the two wars in the world right now. One wouldn't know that by reading the mainstream press. The International Security Assistance Force operation in Afghanistan, 152,000 foreign troops in Afghanistan. That is the largest amount of foreign troops in the history of Afghanistan in that nation. It is the largest amount of contributing countries, what NATO calls troop contributing countries, 48 officially, probably another 10 in addition to that. Never in human history have troops from so many countries engaged in one war, much less in one war theater, not to mention in one country. Similarly, in Libya right now, where NATO has been bombing and blockading the country for 163 days, 151 under control of NATO openly, when U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, passed on the baton, if you will, on March 31st, 151 days of NATO being in charge. By their own account, go to their website, as of today, over 20,000 air missions over over Libya, somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,000 combat missions. This is the nature of the organization we're talking about. The current U.S. permanent representative to NATO, the ambassador to NATO, is a man named Ivo Dalder, originally from the Netherlands. In the early IVO, in the beginning of this century, he's on loan, by the way, from the Brookings Institution, as is a disproportionate amount of leading foreign policy officials in the Obama administration currently. Prior to being appointed permanent representative to NATO by the Obama administration, Mr. Daldo authored several articles talking about the expansion of NATO into a global military force. One of them, in 2006, was co-written by James Goldgeiger, who's a leading member of the Council of Foreign Relations. Mr. Daldo himself, in addition to being a senior fellow of the Brookings Institution, is also a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, International Institute of Strategic Studies, U.S. Atlantic Council. There are 58 Atlantic Councils around the world, which are Trojan horses in countries around the world pushing for NATO integration. And in this article in 2006, the title of which is Global NATO, the opening sentence is, with a little fanfare and even less notice, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization has gone global. This is 5 years ago. In 2008, at the NATO summit in Bucharest, Romania, and I think it's worth noting that since the 50th anniversary NATO summit in Washington, D.C. in 1999, the first and to date only time a NATO summit has been held in the United States, that this occurred against the backdrop of NATO's first war, 78-day bombing campaign against Yugoslavia, the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe, the first post-Cold War expansion of the military bloc, with the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland being pulled in. There are now, of course, 12 Eastern European countries that have been incorporated into NATO. Each of those, to prove their bona fides either after or before the fact, sent troop contingents to Iraq after 2003. And at the end of 2006, the US and NATO ordered those contingents out of Iraq and into Afghanistan. In 2008, George Bush gave a speech as head of state of the United States at the Bucharest summit. His comments included this: as NATO allies fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, our alliance is taking on other important missions across the world. He mentions the fact, but most people don't know this, that for the last 10 years, as part of activating NATO's collective security, basically war clause, Article 5 for the first time ever, that's why there are 152,000 troops from over 50 countries in Afghanistan. The NATO also set up something called Operation Active Endeavor, which put the entire Mediterranean Sea under a NATO-controlled surveillance and interdiction operation, which continues to this day. A comparable operation exists in the Gulf of Aden and in the Arabian Sea called Operation Ocean Shield. In recent weeks, the captain of a Taiwanese shipping vessel was killed by NATO forces. The Taiwanese government has asked for an apology. Two Iranian fishermen were shot by NATO forces, and so this is the scope of what we're talking about. We're not talking about a Cold War period NATO, in a divided Europe. We're talking about a self-proclaimed global force. Bush's comments in 2008 went on after talking about the Mediterranean operation, Balkans operations, Iraq, Afghanistan, and so forth. He says, and I quote him, NATO is no longer a static alliance. It is now an expeditionary alliance that is sending its forces across the world. That is what we're fighting. That's what we're going to be up against on May. And I think the more people realize this unprecedented effort, NATO is not just a military alliance. It's not just the world's biggest military alliance. It is the world's only military alliance, and it is the first attempt in human history to create something like a global military alliance. And this thing is I would argue, the most dangerous manifestation of neoliberalism and attempts for the West to maintain or expand their global control around the world. We will see, for example, our friend here mentioned, leaders of the European Union, leaders of the G8 states, heads of state, including the new Japanese prime minister, and no doubt Russia's Dmitry Medvedev, will attend the NATO conference, the summit, rather. There's no question which is preeminent here. That we saw last year in Lisbon, as was remarked, for the first time ever, a Russian or Soviet head of state attended a NATO summit. We have seen the general secretary, this could go on for 5 hours, but I applaud your efforts. It takes a lot of courage, and I think we have to be particularly aware now that as the NATO campaign, so-called Operation Unified Protector, appears to have succeeded in Libya, the NATO is going to have a new lease on life in terms of the mainstream media and government officials. You're going to say, aha, we told you they could conduct a successful operation, and they will be emboldened to start any number of others in the near future, Syria being the most likely target.